This episode is part of our ongoing series with Queen's University Belfast, where we have the chance to sit down with an interesting student, professor, or graduate once a month to hear and share their story. To find out more and listen to all the other episodes and conversations in this series, please visit bestofbelfast.org/Queens. Today we're sitting down with Robert Jameson, an architect known for his boundary-pushing work through his own practice and involvement in the BBC Netflix show Your Home Made Perfect. In his early days, Robert studied architecture at Queen's and became a lecturer there before moving to London to work on a wide range of projects. After the 2008 crash, Robert booked a one-way plane ticket to India, a trip that continues to impact and influence his work today. In this conversation, we chat about discovering his love for architecture at a young age, almost becoming a fighter pilot in the 80s, the importance of integrating different practices into our work, and the greatest highs and lows experienced along the way. Thanks so much for being here, and we really hope that you enjoy. I love the 80-year-olds that talk about, you know, she's so young, like, how old is she? Oh, she's 71, like, just a wee dote. And you're like, wow, your perspective is totally different, isn't it?
It is like saying, you know, to yourself, you're just a child, 27. I mean, when you're 47, you'll be saying the same to a 27-year-old, yeah. You know?
And I feel young. I don't know if you're a fan of The Hero's Journey.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of The Hero's Journey.
I'm a big fan of his books.
Yeah. And I just feel like, as much as I have gone on a few journeys so far, mm-hmm. I still feel like the wee hobbit.
Right.
And I'm guessing that never really changes.
I think we're constantly going on journeys, you know, because it's always about growth and understanding who you are, but it's about being fearless and going through and pushing through. Because only when you push through do you do this symphony crescendo.
Yeah.
You know, and then you can, and then, or you kind of arrive at that point where you can glide then for months or years. You know, I've experienced that a few times.
Yeah.
But it's the tough times that kind of set you up for living your fullest life, I guess.
Well, it's like taking your glider up a hill really hard, and then you get that effortless season, and it just feels class. Mm-hmm. And you get to the bottom, you're like, that was so fun. What will we do now?
Yes, climb another hill.
You climb another mountain.
Or swim the sea. Yeah.
Turn your glider into a boat, see where you go.
That's the way.
Yeah. I love asking people this, okay? What's the first thing that you can remember?
It's a really interesting question. Holding a balloon.
Yeah.
And looking at the starry sky.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you remember the color of the balloon?
No. I remember the dark. I remember the starry sky.
Wow. Where were you?
No idea.
Were you on the island?
No.
Interesting.
Was there
the island of Ireland?
The
sorry.
Island of Ireland. yes, I was.
That makes me think I should ask about an island later on, but I guess we'll leave that for now.
Yes, I was on the island of Ireland because, I mean, I'm one of seven, the youngest of seven.
Mm.
We grew up in a 3-bed council house rented property.
Class.
There was 9 of us in a 3-bedroom property.
Tell me about your bedroom. Who was in it?
At one point, there was 6 of us in it. There was a, you know, there's a
triple bunks?
No, they didn't exist then. There was a bunk next to a double bed next to a single bed. And that was a time when my eldest brother wasn't well, and so he had his own room first. It was just for a short period, you know. But we then moved to another property, which seemed kind of more salubrious, still 3-bed. But I remember we had... in the boys' room, there were 2 bunk beds with a space of about 500 mil in between to the window. And then you had your wooden box with your clothes in it underneath.
Yeah.
And in the girls' room, there was 4 of them, 2 bunks, you know, so.
Mad.
Mm-hmm.
7.
So I guess my point is that we didn't, our holidays, you know, we were always in the island of Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't venture too far.
Were you more of a mountain, forest or sea guy?
Well, back then, you mean as a child?
Yes, Chad.
Well, our family holidays would be to the beach, but it was Ballyhornan Beach, the private beach that's no longer private. It's nice. Public. And it was actually owned, my father worked in the Ministry of Agriculture. So he knew the farmer. He owned the land. Class. And the only way to get to this beach, which was this, you know, golden beach, was through his land. Mm-hmm. So we would get access and be often the only ones on the beach.
Wow.
So that was our kind of holiday.
That's cool.
It was great. But mountains, I love the mountains.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's about that idea of getting into nature, you know, you're closest to nature when you're immersed in water.
Mm.
Really, you know, I love the water. I love Strangford Loch. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how people from Belfast either kind of migrate on holiday to the North Coast or the East Coast.
It's true.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm a East Coast down. There's so much around there. Nendrum, I grew up in Cumber, so I, you know,
nice.
We cycle around there. Strangford Loch, I go kayaking in Strangford Loch. The history around there, it's really interesting. And then you've got the Moor Mountains. You know, it's all there for me.
Yeah.
You know, and even kind of the peninsula. You know, in the Far East. I mean, whoever travels the Far East, south edge of the peninsula, where it's, you know, you feel like you're in Donegal.
Yeah, you do.
You know, there's no one there, and the beach is there, and so
that's cool.
I have a camper van.
Oh,
So I kind of like get in the way, and I was at a festival there with my 5-year-old last weekend. Yeah, so I kind of enjoy getting out and exploring. There's a lot to see just around here.
Yeah, talk to me about school. How did you and school mix?
We didn't.
Okay.
I mean, I remember primary school. Well, primary school? I went to Methody.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, all my siblings, my 4 siblings above me went to Methody. So I kind of was the natural place to go. But I was always being kind of pulled along because, you know, you want to be with them, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I remember doing my 11 plus. Back then it was 11 plus.
I did 11 plus.
Right.
I even know I'm a kid. I still did the 11 plus.
Right. The good old days.
Good old days,
no
man.
Phones. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate technology.
Me too.
So yeah, went to, I remember P6 teacher in Andrews Memorial, primary school in Cumber. Told my folks that I shouldn't do my 11 plus because I wouldn't get it. Yeah, it's kind of like red rag the bill for any person. Anyway, I ended up getting an A.
Love it.
Went to Methody. And again, you know, I was kind of like, Methody's great as an experience, meeting people. I'm not academic. I don't have a good memory for, you know, I think if you've got a good memory, you can do what you want.
Yeah.
Because that's how schooling is set up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for me, that's a problem.
Yeah, it's a memory game, really.
It's a memory game. Yeah. And, you know, and I guess when I was at Queen's, my tutor knew that. And so it kind of like, going back to school, I mean, I kind of just got through my GCSEs. I mean, we didn't know where, again, there was like that 3-bedroom house, you know.
Yeah, where you going to study?
There was nowhere to study.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There was nowhere, you know. There was we had a piano next to a TV, right? And even my sister, all of us were trying to practice piano, but next to a TV. And, you know, it was just the most interesting kind of, you know, mix of energy, you know.
Yeah.
Growing up.
But so in that schooling system, which, I mean, that's a different podcast. We can talk about that.
It is.
Was there a subject that you really, really loved, and was it different to the subject that you scored the best in, or was it the same?
I loved art, but I was told that I couldn't do it.
Interesting.
I was told that I couldn't do it.
Because you couldn't draw apples, or?
Also because I didn't know where to do my homework. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Were you going to put this big square,
right?
Black art portfolio?
How are you going to afford one? We didn't have one of them. How are you going to afford one of them, you know? I mean, as a kid, I went to schools, you know, with kind of the blazer from the year before.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
They always turned up in their new blazers. But that didn't bother me. But yeah, I've been told I couldn't do art, and I wanted to be an architect.
From that age?
I knew from the age of 11.
Oh, well, forget all that. Give me that then.
Right. Of course, it goes back to my growing up in the conditions and the environment that I did, you know, where you'd know, you know, just... I often wondered how other people would live. And I said, past houses, you know, I always wondered what was behind that door.
Mm.
And then I went to Methody, and this guy, he was, you know, in the first day, first class, this guy was sitting beside me, Richard Finlay. And he's a good friend of mine now. In fact, he shares this studio space with me. He's a graphic designer. But his dad was an architect. And I remember being at his house when I was 11 in first year. And it's really interesting. Because his dad had left university. Back that generation, you left university as an architect. You built your own house, right? I mean, that was a natural kind of...
The personal project.
Right? You could afford to. It was architecture, you know, it was well paid, you know? And the house was interesting in that kind of, there was no kind of real entrance hall. There was a dining space. There was, you know, there was the open, it was kind of mid-century modern influence. You know, there's the open staircase. There was the plate glass window looking the garden. There was what felt like the sunken seating in the floor.
Yeah.
And I was saying to him recently, you know, that I must go back and walk through his house again because of the memories I had. There was in the conservatory, there was this kind of green painted steel work, you know, it was really unusual. I thought this was really interesting, you know, and because how it kind of makes you feel or, you know, I mean, essentially that's what, like our homes are so important because they impact on how we feel and how we live and how we are, you know, and who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first experience. I thought, yeah, I'd like to be an archetype.
Isn't it interesting that you don't have a good memory? I'm doing the wee scare quotes here. But you can, like, verbatim walk into that house in your head and tell me about it.
Oh, I mean, I can do all that. I mean, especially when it comes to understanding, you know, a city. I can be in a city, wander through a city, and find my way back a different route. But yeah.
So you went to school in Methody.
Mm-hmm.
You went to uni across the road.
I went to uni.
Why did you go to uni?
Well, I failed. Like at Methody, I could kind of triumphantly failed.
Yeah.
Oh, my A levels. Because I couldn't do art. I couldn't be an archetype.
Yeah.
Right. But I had another interest at the time, which was kind of, I was in the Air Cadets.
Interesting.
And I also was in the Army Cadets as well, but that's like, you're not allowed to do or have membership to both, but I did. And I remember, so I've got a lot of, you know, I've got 70 hours flying experience. I spent 2 weeks with the Red Arrows in Cyprus.
Nice.
You know, so, I mean, I've flown gliders, you know, so I had a real interest in and passion for aeronautics and flight. You know, jet fighters, you know, just, I remember I was following kind of, you know, the Top Gun came out. I was, what, 12 maybe back then. And then those years, you know, coming up to 13, you know, I was in the Air Cadets and I thought, well, I'll apply to do aeronautical engineering.
Yeah.
But most interestingly was I was thinking, sure, if I'm going to go into the Air Force, I want to be a fighter pilot.
Sure.
So I passed all my tests, save, and I was like, and you know, in Aldergrove, I went to do all the tests. Then I went to Biggin Hill in London to do further tests. You know, I remember I was kind of swatting up on Perestroika and Glasnost and kind of, you know, the Iron Curtain and all that politics. And, you know, as part of the interview to discuss kind of your wider general knowledge. And I failed my medical.
No.
On my eyesight.
No way.
And they're like, no, but you can still be a transport pilot or a commercial pilot. I mean, no thanks. So I just kind of had no interest in my A-levels. And yeah, I remember I was clubbing the weekend before my Maz A-level, you know, at the Art College. Those were the days, early 90s, you know. But anyway, I failed miserably. Not miserably, triumphantly. I feel triumphantly. So I got an N in my maths. But then I found Downpatrick Tech had the best results for anybody repeating their A-levels.
Okay.
And I would travel. I would walk across a field and get two buses to Downpatrick every day. And the maths tutors were brilliant. I recall their names. But they were brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant. And every Friday you had a test, and if you failed your test, you were out. Yeah. Like discipline.
Brutal, bro.
Right? Right?
That's like the Air Force. It's like...
But hold on a sec. That's the way, you know, like, instead of... Anyway.
Well, yeah, yeah. Whole, another podcast.
That's a whole, you know, millennial conversation.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I then get an MMAs within a year.
Wow.
I remember going back to tell my teacher in Methody. And she actually, you know, she thought maybe I was something up and invited me to leave the school. Like, how is this possible?
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's a whole other story. But so I started Queens in 93.
Wow.
Loved it. Loved the creative side of it, you know?
Sure. So take me back, like you as a student going through your degree, mm-hmm. you just came from high school.
Okay.
How did that transition broaden your mind or open your mind, or what was that experience like for you? That's a better way to do it.
The transition through uni?
Secondary school to university.
I was set up for it. I mean, I was kind of like, I mean, in terms of, I guess the way I kind of grew up, kind of not hardened me, but made me realize that I can kind of, you know, I'm pretty streetwise.
Sure.
You know, also what's interesting actually, which I feel is part of my practice, or it's kind of like another thread to my practice, is the growing up in Belfast in the 80s and 90s, you know, it wasn't a great place to be often as a male, walking through certain parts of Belfast or being out socializing, because at that age you're out socializing.
Sure.
And I was very aware. I could feel the energy in a room. Like, I could pick it up like that, mm-hmm. whether it was in a room, in a bar, on the street, even at a distance, you know, and I was pretty accurate. And so university was a great experience, but it was very different back then. Oh my goodness, like, we were in Clarion Gardens. I also, I had decks, turntables, Technics, right, and a mixer, and even my student flat, you know, it was part of the party house. I remember even in Clarion Gardens in the School of Architecture, we would have end of year parties and get bouncers from the Students' Union to come and do the door, and it was bring your own. I remember we would sit in the Students' Union on a Friday, you know, and on a Friday we'd meet there, a few of us. I mean, I worked hard, but I played hard.
You know, so I wanted to ask, did you treat your architecture degree the same way you treated the Air Force? Was it that same drive, that same passion? Because you talk about school, okay. You didn't really care about school.
Okay, so I was, even before I went to uni, I was out partying. But I remember in uni, you know, it wasn't, you know, I was like, I had to, you know, I was there to focus. Yeah. But I was there to focus because I knew I could do it.
Yeah.
Because there was a project, and one of our first projects in first year was design your dream home, you know. And you're given this volume, 3x6x9 or 2x4x6. So it could be a one story, two story, or three story, right?
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah, the design inside of it. But I took it all out, you know, and designed outside of it, because there was no limit on, you know, external space and balconies and all this, mm-hmm. you know. And that's what, for me, that's what architecture is about. It's about finding the idea. It's not about all that stuff, the shit that they teach you. I'll not say that, because it's important to understand, you know,
you got to know the rules so you can break the rules, that sort of thing.
You got to know the rules, exactly right. Yeah. But you can be influenced, but you don't want to be heavily influenced by the history of architecture either.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't back then. But I remember I did that, and I thought, here, and I get, you know, a great result in that. I think I get, you know, top of class even. And I thought, I can do this. You know, I can do this. And then getting the second year, I'm trying to think what year it was, 74. Yes. No, it was third. It was third year. It was second year, I got a tattoo, right? And then a tattoo, there would almost be a kind of a stamp,
yeah.
That was about my, you know, passion to be an architect. And it was a symbol that had all these ideas embedded within it, you know. I got my 21st birthday, you know, it looks like a caricature of a building. Like that. I thought, I'm going to get this tattoo, because then I will.
Yeah.
I will work. That's my kind of like, you know,
the force and function.
Right. So I, and I worked and, but I would, I mean, I would be in the studio at 8 o'clock in the morning and I might leave and, you know, go for a walk or I mean, I'm always thinking about the work in the library. And then maybe afternoon or in, like in the evening, maybe grab a couple of beers from the, you know, the bar, the off license there at the bar, and go in the Clarion Gardens and have a couple of beers. And we would have a, you know, fridges in there. We had our drawing board set up.
Nice.
And it's drawing boards back then, right?
Yeah.
We had our drawing board set up. The music was on. You know, we had fridges. There was guys with a big TV for any sports that were on, you know, and you were on this kind of really social environment. It was fantastic, right? But we worked.
Yeah.
We worked. We would sit and we would drink, but we would discuss architecture. Mm-hmm. We would discuss ideas. And that's why we were there, like, you know.
Yeah.
It was fascinating. It was being able to talk about architecture, about, you know, environment, going off to, on field trips, you know, working on interesting kind of ideas. Whenever I was teaching then, I was teaching.
So, yeah, that's the bit that I find interesting as well. You became a lecturer.
I was kind of, after I graduated, the whole Celtic Tiger thing, right?
Yeah.
I moved to Dublin. There's a few of us moved to Dublin, right? And we partied for the summer in Dublin. And then started working for a commercial practice, right? Big practice. They were taking on anybody. It was, you know, there's so much work. So worked for a big commercial practice. There was about 60 staff. Average age was about 28. Like young graduates, you know? Wow. That was great for a period of time, getting to know Dublin, the, you know, the social elements of it, meeting people. And then I realized, like, I need to do something else. I mean, I started doing a night class in dressmaking, you know, making clothes just to get the creative, just to have a creative output. I started doing projects that were in this, redoing projects in my own time that were part of the office, thinking, and then, you know, this is very, very commercial. We can try something different. And then I remember realizing what commercial architecture was at that time. I was like, I need to get the fuck out of this.
Yeah.
You know, this is poison, right? But that's what graduates are facing now.
Sure.
They come out, it's just all commercial. I heard about a guy who had moved back from Berlin to Dublin called Martin Henschen. I hunted him down. I was in this kind of corner of this warehouse building on the docks, all demolished since. And I asked him if he'd come work for him. And he said no. He said there might be a project coming, but at the minute there's not. He phoned me. In fact, I then went, I actually was offered a job for a guy who used to teach Martin on Raglan Road in Dublin. And I worked there. And 2 weeks later, after starting work there, Martin offered me a job.
Nice.
And I had to say, listen, I'm sorry, I need to leave. I mean, there's an opportunity here that I want to take. I was like, how dare you? I used to teach that guy, how dare you? Anyway, I went off to work for Martin, worked there for a couple of years, you know, worked on a couple of really interesting projects, again, absorbing all his, you know, or his information, but also the people I was working with. There was three of us in the office, and there was two others, and they were brilliant architects, you know. And so it was enjoyable being part of that dynamic of architecture again, you know. Then I thought, I'm going to move north. After I got a couple of years experience there, and I was offered two jobs here. One was with a guy called Colin Box Architects, which is just around the corner here. And the reason why I worked for him, because he offered me the pothouse project, that site. And the pothouse, you know what a pothouse is?
Yeah.
Well, there was nothing there before. That was just, it was just an empty, that's where the prostitutes hung out. That's where the drug addicts hung out. Hill Street was derelict.
Yeah.
And this project in the corner. And actually in fifth year, I'd done a project in uni on that site. And for a microbrewery. And again, I remember winning that award in fifth year in Queens. And this was a project for that site, for a pub. So anyway, so I designed and built the pothouse. Has changed somewhat since then. It had glass floors. I'm not sure if you were back then. It had glass floors. It was a glass dance floor, two levels, and I designed the furniture, and there's this here concrete. It was all concrete inside. There's this concrete table that wrapped through the building, or sorry, the main floor, and really defined the space and how you would use the space. And it's really interesting. I really enjoyed that. And then, so I worked with Colin. He gave me that project and gave me, and then I won the Spire competition.
Mm.
Whilst working with Colin, I also built the Black Box as a project, and the Four Corners Hotel, mm-hmm. so all around there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd won the Spire competition, and then I had a couple of commissions I was offered, so then I started my own practice. And over here in East Belfast,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the question was. It was about Dublin, wasn't it? Leaving. Yeah, Belfast.
At what point did you start teaching at Queen's?
Oh, yes. So when I was working here before, and working in the pothouse, I was offered a place at Queen's teaching. And it was interesting. I loved it. I loved being there and talking to students, and because I'm passionate about what I do. And,
yeah.
And it's about bringing the creative energy out of them. Mm-hmm. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Forget about the textbooks. If you can show them that learning that they've drawn has come through a creative process,
mm-hmm.
and they felt that, and they see, and I'm saying that's perfect. That's beautiful. I can see it.
Yeah.
And I know it. Then that instills that confidence in them to believe in their own creative energy.
Mm.
I loved it. I was teaching. In fact, when I started teaching there, I took on three studio roles. You're only supposed to do one. I had to go on three because there was a shortage of staff. I was like, I'll do it. So I was spending a lot of time in the studio. And we went on field trips. We took the students to Berlin. We took the students to Basel and Bale in Switzerland on field trips. They're got amazing architecture. And that was the phase of undergrad. And then I moved to London. So I was like, I could be working, I was working in East Belfast and had a couple of interesting projects on. I'd built Paul Stafford's on the Lisburn Road.
Oh yeah, cool.
And, and I'd built a house that has been published up in Antrim, an interesting project, and won an award out of San Francisco with that project because it's all timber. So I'd been working on a few projects, and I thought I could be working anywhere. And I wanted to kind of move on to that next stage of off practice, like bigger projects, the schools, the museums, the galleries. I was doing a lot of competition work.
Yeah.
I had been shortlisted for the Lyric competition.
Mm.
I had, and of course I won the Spark competition. And anyway, so I moved to London. In fact, I thought I could be in New York or London.
Yeah.
I'll go to London first. And I walked from Farringdon Station to Spitalfields, and I knew that was the most densely kind of populated community of architects on the planet.
Wow!
Right, so I just walked through to see just get a feel for the area or the areas because I wanted to engage with engineers and other specialists, right? Because I had worked with an amazing engineer in the Spire who I've worked with since previously in other projects, and called Anton Savisky. He was actually the engineer for the Tate extension. A really interesting guy, great guy. He's a friend of mine now. But so I walked that journey, and within 4 weeks, I had moved to London. Mm. I found a place. I thought, well, the cost of rent of a house and a studio, I could buy a place. And that's when our mortgages or the whole thing was. And I had a house here that I was kind of, you were paying the mortgage. I mean, back then you were kind of trying to make ends meet,
yeah.
But you were, you were getting 0% interest in this card, and you were transferring that to that, and you had all these. I'm not sure if you're aware of that, are you?
Yeah.
0%, right? And you were just moving your way through to try and get to the next stage of living, right?
Yeah.
And I ended up actually then buying a place in Shoreditch because it was cheaper than renting two places.
Yeah.
And I moved over and my studio was there, and it was amazing. Like, there was right on my doorstep, there was drug addicts, but there was, you know, then across the way there was a Pet Shop Boys, and you know, it was just really this vibrant kind of East London, but north of the top of Brick Lane, just before it was all gentrified and what do you call those guys? Pret a Manger. God.
Yeah.
And Sainsbury's local shit. Anyway, that's where we live in. That's what happens. But I moved there and
that was the practice years?
For 2 years.
Yeah.
Until the crash.
So this is good. Have you Googled your name recently?
I only to get into my website.
Yeah, me too. I don't know why. It's far easier to Google to get to your own website than it is to type it in.
Yeah.
But if you Google your name, and if you scroll down a wee bit, you know, sometimes Google has like the drop down boxes.
Yes.
So the first drop down box of your name is "What happened to Robert Jameson?" And right, I think that's gotta be one of the coolest little life accolades you could pick up, is that enough people were Googling what happened to this guy.
Right.
That Google earmarks it as a need to know question.
Right.
And it was around the time of 2008. So let me ask you, what happened to
was
Robert
that
Jameson?
2008?
Yeah.
So 2009, so of course the financial collapse.
Uh-huh.
I ended up working as a labourer on a building site 3 days a week, so I could pay. I was a graduate here. I was teaching. It was a Belgian guy, Erasmus student, who was here in Queens. He then came to work with me in London. And there was another, actually, girl from, who was at Queens as well, who came to work with me in London. So there was three of us. And I was working 3 days a week on a building site to pay for the projects to come to an end so I could close my practice, because it was totally... It wasn't working. Like, I mean, you could see that the bigger practices were scooping up all the small work and the competition work. I was like, what's the point? This is going one way. And I rented out my place in London, and I got a one-way ticket to India on the 16th of September.
So talk to me about, I mean, this is, we're talking classic hero's journey here, right?
Mm-hmm.
You leave.
Yeah.
You go on the journey. The most important, well, I think the most important step of the hero's journey is the last bit. And that's coming home. And you come home changed. So I look at what you've told me today, right?
Mm-hmm.
You started off in your family home.
Yeah.
Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
You then go to Methody. You then go to Queens.
Mm-hmm.
You then teach at Queens.
Mm-hmm.
You then go to London. You're faced with the dark night of the soul. You're faced with a crisis. The dragon starts roaring the fire, mm-hmm. burning you up.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets you off on the India journey.
Yeah.
You come back home.
Mm-hmm.
How are you different?
Well, I traveled on. I traveled on from India. I had this opportunity to kind of, you know, I mean, different, just experienced, understand, knowing the world we live in a little bit more, even though we don't know it. My plan was to leave India and go to Mongolia and buy 2 horses. Right? And I was in contact with a supplier there. But it was a harsh winter. 2 million horses died.
My goodness.
So I ended up going to Australia, where I was living in an oyster community in a beautiful part of north of Sydney, the Hawkesbury River. But then my mother wasn't well. And I come back. I surprised her twice on my birthday. Birthdays were a big thing. Growing up in a big family, there were the parties that you had, you know. And my mother wasn't well. And anyway, so I came back. I came back and then I was offered, when I was back, I remember I was back for a month, and then, you know, I would end the competitions. I was still at no office or no practice, but I was still at the competitions. And, but when I was back, I got a phone call from a guy who I lived near to in London, who offered me a project. I mean, okay, I'll hang out in London for a year. 2012. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Olympics.
Well, Olympics, but also the work I was doing. I was creating communities. Or I was given this huge kind of site over three postcodes, an industrial warehouse site in next to Hackney Downs. And I was given 12 builders. And I had to keep them busy. That was creating.
Wow.
I was, you know, the guy said, bring me your master plan. You know, within 2 weeks, and then you know you've got 12 builders to keep busy. So I came back with a master plan because it had to be kind of ad hoc in many ways. So there's a master plan there, and it was kind of creating the, you know, the going back to the village, you know, idea or the town squares and creating streets and squares and courtyards and all that. And it's now Hackney Down Studios. It's a successful.
Wow.
Yeah. And I also built Nettle House. Sorry, Nettle Roof. I was working in Nettle House, and Nettle Roof became one of those first kind of rooftop venues in London.
Mm-hmm.
2012. I remember I impacted on the cost of scaffolding boards in the UK economy because I was buying so much of it. I was building all sorts. I was building stages. I was building toilets. I was building showers. I was building cafes. I was, you know, building venues. And scaffolding board was a very cheap and, you know, and interesting kind of material,
mm-hmm.
you know, and use it in many ways. And it's in Rita Ora's video, the venue. She's got a video that, you know, with a scaffolding board in the background and this here kind of interesting textured wall. I was using materials and just working with texture and materials. It was really interesting. That was 2012. And then 2013, I left that after a year and went traveling again, went to China and I bought a motorbike in Vietnam and traveled through Vietnam and traveled in China and Singapore and Malaysia. Anyway, I then came back because my mother really wasn't well because she had fought cancer, but then it had returned, and that was me coming back, and then that whole journey, you know.
Sure.
And and then I hung out with my dad after that, after she passed away, and I didn't open my practice then. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a practice, although I was working. So I, you know, there's a building I work in here, which is quite discreet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I choose to keep it discreet. It's an old school building, and I was working there, and I had a couple of interesting projects, but I had no studio.
Yeah,
and then I was contacted about doing TV work,
mm-hmm.
which is a whole other story because we can get into that topic if you want. But so that's the journey.
Okay. So that's where the BBC, the Netflix, all that stuff came from at that stage of your life. Yeah,
yeah, it came from just I was offered one episode of one project. I'm sorry, half an episode of a series, which was called 100K House, Tricks of the Trade, small budgets.
Yeah.
And this was for a post office up in Yorkshire in Goole.
Love it.
The budget was 10 grand. They were living in this here kind of village square, glass front, living room. Couldn't live there. Lived upstairs. Living room was upstairs. And I totally transformed it. And came in on their budget.
Amazing.
On their budget by getting him to do all the work. And it was just about those things. It's about that change. You know, I realized from doing that TV work. Well, I guess off the back of that episode, I was offered to create a pilot for Your Home Made Perfect, which became Your Home Made Perfect. And I did two series of Your Home Made. This is before I had a studio. I was offered to do Your Home Made Perfect, right? And myself and this girl, Laura, all her archetype, were going head-to-head, I'm sure you know. And we had to go and visit 16 projects. So in the first series, there were 16 projects. And we had to go and visit every home on camera all over the UK. Then come up with the idea and draw it up, spec it, and send it off to the VR company in London within 6 weeks.
Oh, mate.
Right?
Brutal.
I was like, oh, shit, this is it. This is interesting. This is it. I'm up for a challenge, right?
Yeah.
I mean, impossible when you think about it. But that body of work, 6 weeks, became series one and series two. There's so much information. There's so much to take out of it. And it was such a short period of my my work on, you know, of course in the green screen and then the reveals, but I only had a couple of projects I built, you know. And the green screen was interesting, you know, to kind of share the ideas with all the clients. And it was only after that came on to BBC Two and the work just started coming in, and I thought I have to open up another practice here.
Yeah.
And that's when I opened up my new practice. Still discreet, still off of Lisburn Road.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had, I mean, I'm getting projects offered every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't, you know, I could have room of architects working for me. I could be, you know, working on loads of projects.
Yeah.
But I don't want to manage people. Mm-hmm. I want to work on projects myself. And I've offered collaborations with other architects to come in or other practices, you know, but then they're doing their own thing. They want to have their own, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I've actually, you know, I've spoke to a friend of Professor Queen's about this, you know, about the amount of work coming in and just not being able to do it, you know. But not that I want to do it all, but I want to share it.
Because I
know that there are great architects out there who don't have any opportunity and they're working for shit commercial practices here in the city. I mean, you just have to look at Belfast City and see how crap the architect. I mean, people don't even know what architecture is.
What is architecture?
It was Buckminster, Richard Buckminster Fuller, who said the difference between architecture and building is understanding the universe.
Mm.
And architecture are those buildings that you walk into and you feel something different.
Mm.
You know, and it doesn't happen. I mean, in our city, I mean, there's a couple of examples of, you know, there's a handful of examples of great architecture in the city, you know.
Where's somewhere you walk into and you feel it?
I used to feel it. I mean, obviously examples of contemporary architecture, like the Lyric,
mm-hmm.
right? Really superb design, like really interesting kind of experience and how you walk up that grand staircase, but how that, you know, that route, that, you know, circular route within it that takes you to more private spaces and you come up and you see the, I mean, that's a great piece of architecture.
Yeah.
And the brick and it's solid and it's kind of has that presence and all of that. It's a great building. I mean, the Mac is also piece of architecture, yeah. You know, those guys are, you know, Hall McKnight are, you know, are doing some great work. But, and the Glass House, of course, there's the Glass House and then there's the Tropical Ravine.
Yeah.
But the Glass House, those structures that connect you to nature.
Yeah.
For me, the best architecture, and I say this to my clients, is that you don't, that dissolves.
Mm-hmm.
That you're not aware of it.
Yeah.
You know, because it harnesses life force energy
mm-hmm.
between you and another, like here, or you and life, like what's beyond, like outside, so you're connecting with outside, or the foodstuffs, or, you know, or whatever it is, mm-hmm. it's life and living and relationship. And that's the best architecture. It just supports and nourishes that.
Yeah.
And we live in these kind of boxes. I mean, this is kind of, it's interesting because my work, and people say, like, you know, what would you like to build or what's your project, you know? And it's like, for me, living needs to be dealt with.
Mm.
Like, the way we live is just so damaging to our
everything,
our being. Like, yeah. It really impacts on us. Square boxes. Whenever I come home from traveling, I had an aversion to corners of a room. I was in rooms. I was like, fuck, I have to get out of here.
Yeah.
And I remember going that weekend to a festival on my own just to sleep in a tent.
Sure.
And hang out with kind of like interesting, you know, free, you know, like freer people who were there just to experience the vibration of music and each other, you know, and I can't come back from that. I'm off again.
Yeah.
You know, and I had to kind of like, it's interesting, you know, kind of how I have those aversions, you know, and that's why other practices allow you to kind of, you know, deal with those aversions. Like, so for example, I you know, Vipassana meditation, you know, it teaches you, it's about being in equanimity, right? Mm-hmm. And I kind of practice Vipassana and practice meditation. And that's whenever you have no aversion. That's why, you know, and in conversation, if you're in conversation and you're the calmest person, especially when you've got your parent, gee, that's the real teaching when you're a parent, you know. But remaining calm and not having that aversion. And I remember one time, this is, you know, a while ago, thinking, I have the aversion to the world we live in, or I could just focus on meditation and become, then I wouldn't have this issue with where they live in, and, you know, or the built environment, let's say. And I thought, no, I want to focus on the built environment and try and kind of throw out solutions, you know, and these kind of, but still we build these boxes, and still they're celebrated, and still a few years ago, the Stirling Prize, the most prestigious award in for the RIBA, you know, of building was housing. Okay, but it was social housing. I think that's why it won the award. Mm-hmm. But it still had those boxes, still had those rooms that are not supportive of our energetic being, of our need. And that's why we want to leave buildings, and we love to get outside, and we want to walk in the forest or climb a mountain. We are connected energetically with other.
Yeah. So that's interesting, because I kind of wanted to go here. Talk to me about the merging of your practices. And what I mean by that is, I think a lot of us in our lives, we're quite decompartmentalized.
Mm-hmm.
This is my work. I go to my work.
Uh-huh.
Maybe in the evening, I do my yoga practice.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe on the weekend, I practice some form of worship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all kind of boxed off.
Yes.
I look at you, and I don't know if it's a pre-trip or post-trip thing, or if it was just always like that for you. But I look at you and I see someone who has managed to integrate a lot of those different parts into your daily life. And I think that's very interesting.
That was an epiphany, actually, for me, realizing that, like, I need to merge this.
Yeah.
I need to kind of be, you know, because I guess when you're so far into something, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you're, like, Joe Rogan, for example, is so far into MMA that it's very much part of his thing, right?
Yeah.
So I believe that totally. Whatever your interests are, merge them. So as a graduate architect, if you're also a runner, merge them. Or if you're in whatever way that is, you know, merge your practices, you know. So I kind of but only because I see the creative it's creative intelligence that creates. Who's God, right? Where's God? We get in that whole conversation. Sure. There's a great book, actually, I'm reading at the moment, called The Naked Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You should check it out. But we all have creative energy. We're all creators, in my opinion, right?
I agree with that opinion.
We're all God, because we create. We create every moment. I'm sitting in this seat because I created that experience of sitting in this seat, right? Mm-hmm. But we're all creators. And I used to actually teach that in the studio, in terms of, like, I used to set projects for my students that were, and it wasn't your standard, it was like a school of emotional intelligence. So they had to find out what emotional intelligence was. Or a school of, precious metal exchange. Or not a school, sorry, a building for the precious metal exchange. And this is going back 7 years. 6 or 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not. Maybe 5 or 6 years. And the precious metal exchange is so relevant today.
So there's a series of stock questions that we end every single episode with, okay?
Okay.
And these are for you just to do whatever you want with. Take them whatever way. Personal, professional, whatever. I love hearing how you can ask the same questions to everybody and you get different stuff back. First one. What was your most challenging moment in your life? I mean, like, the bottom of the bottom. And how were you able to overcome it, if you don't mind me asking? If you don't mind sharing.
Challenging. I remember, actually, just being ill in India, actually. And I had a train, but I was laying in this guest house, but it wasn't even a guest house. You know, it was like a cell. Mm. Even bars and windows, and I was being sick from both ends, and I had no idea how I was ever going to get out of there.
Yeah,
I was there for like 7-8 hours, 9 hours, and then, but knowing that you had to get up and get on, and I remember, like, almost literally crawling.
Yeah,
trying to get the pharmacist, trying to get water, trying to get this, you know, and. So I remember that being a kind of a moment, but just a few weeks later, when I was up in the Himalaya, and I came back down from the altitude, you know, that it was at, where I was getting, and I was thinking, and I remember there was a people at what was a rock, but it was obviously a bus stop,
And I just had to pull my trousers down and like go to the toilet. Sure. Just, well, and people are, you know, because you know that you were just in such anguish, you know. But the, you know, you care less. And I think that's really important. It's about the caring less, you know, because we're all human. And when people are suffering, people generally help them. They, like they don't kind of you know, stand beside and watch. But of course, then people stood beside and watched me because I was out of rucksack and everything. I was pretty
sure.
I was pretty okay. But yeah, I mean, just and when you're really kind of, and this is a thing about sickness, you know. It's important to be healthy.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it's more. I want to grow old, healthy. I want to kind of. I would like to be conscious when I'm taking my last breath. You know, and be completely, totally content in that.
Sure. Give me the flip side then. Most successful moment or the proudest moment so far?
I mean, God, when you're a father, like when you have kids. You only get to realize, you know, you only really get to understand or start to understand who you are, how you react. You get goosebumps just thinking about it, you know. My boy, Forrester, he's five, but he changes, like, and the conversations we have and, you know, seeing him grow and, you know. I mean, and you know, you just want to cherish it all. You just want to pause, and then you look at photographs from like you might, you know, months or years ago, and you think, "Gee, remember him there?" And how quick they're changing, you know. But it's important as well to realize that, you know, and that's why I only work, on a Tuesday morning, on a Wednesday, and a Thursday morning, because I am spending my time with the family, you know, because soon they'll be up and away. And they will be let go.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I think that's really important. I think that's what happened, you know, like when you are, like when you're of an age, you go and, you know, the parents, it's important to let them go and do their thing. And then they come back. Yeah. Or they're there, you know, and I remember boys go and go. Girls, they say, are the ones who come back and look after, you know, their parents. But, yeah, just kids. You know, I've got a 1 year old as well.
Nice.
Raphael Shiva. And he's like, he's just such a joy. You know, that brings you into your reality. And you know, whenever you kind of spend time with them, it really is timeless. And, you know, it's living in the present. People say, you know, kind of, be present, be mindful.
Yeah,
you can only be mindful when you're with the kids.
Yeah,
and it's a massive journey. I think that's important. Yeah. I realize it as an important journey. You know.
Yeah, for sure.
And it won't last too long either.
Oh no, it's gone. If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a cup of coffee, who would you take?
From Northern Ireland for a cup of coffee. My mother.
Where would you take her?
She never had experience. I would take her to somewhere like the Merchant.
Nice.
You know, just that room. It's a magnificent old bank space, you know. Yeah. And I took her there before for high tea.
Nice.
And she really loved it. So, yeah.
Awesome. Final question then. If you could go back in a time machine or whatever to a Robert who was just about to go to Queens. Say you were walking to your first class on your first day. And you could walk alongside him for a couple of minutes, put your arm around him and say something to him. What would you say to him?
Life is good.
Yeah.
Enjoy it all. And it's really, you know, it's really when you kind of, you know, frame it like that and looking back, but you know, you can take any moment. of your life, and we worry too much. And that's why I think it's so important that it's the worry and how, and the impact of worry and fear. And we can talk about, you know, the fear that's being pushed at us and how that impacts on the immune system. And, you know, it's like we need to be fearless. We need to not care or care less. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important teaching, to care less.
Mm-hmm.
Care less, like, you know, but we hear it all. You know, when we're growing up, we hear that.
I know.
But putting in the practices, and we can only reflect on it. And that's why I think personally speaking, the older I get, the more better life becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably because you've learned to care. Like, I don't care very much, you know, in terms of, like, you know, because all those challenges that you face are to kind of teach you another part of who you are, and you know, take lessons from that. And yeah, but it's hard to kind of, he wouldn't listen. he'd probably say, come on, go for a pint.
Yeah. Awesome.
Or something.
Well, Robert, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
Had a blast.
All right.
And that's a wrap.